WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So where do St. Louis, Toronto, Al Jazeera all intersect with research on the autocratic right and authoritarian states? Where do they all intersect? Well, they all intersect in the work of Sarah Kendzior, reporter, op-ed columnist for the Globe and Mail, and author of The View from Flyover Country, Dispatches from the Forgotten America. Welcome to WNYC, Sarah.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'll just jump right in here on the fact that much of your reporting is focused on your hometown of St. Louis, mm-hmm. and the Midwest by extension. Is St. Louis emblematic of Flyover Country, the title of your book?
I wouldn't say anything is emblematic exactly, because, you know, one of the biggest myths about so-called flyover country is that we're this kind of monolith, you know, that states are interchangeable, that cities are interchangeable, you know, but there's a lot of diversity both within St. Louis and within the region itself. I think it may be emblematic, maybe a little bit ahead of its time, in that we experienced certain crises earlier, whether, you know, the economic recession, the racial strife of Ferguson, you know, or the presidential election and the kind of issues that Trump brought to the forefront.
And you also write about having a fairly early idea that Trump might actually win the election. Where did it come from?
Yeah, unfortunately, that came out of my research. I have a PhD in anthropology, and I focused on the authoritarian states of Central Asia. And when Trump began to run, I looked at that and I thought, oh my God, you know, this guy reminds me of a Central Asian autocrat. He's going to govern like a Central Asian autocrat. And because I was in a state where he was gaining traction, and I was encountering people who planned to vote for him, and also seeing how he manipulated the media, I thought he had a good chance of winning, and that if he won, he would rule in an extremely corrupt way, which she is.
Do you think they're getting what they want from Trump in St. Louis?
Well, St. Louis didn't want Trump. I mean,
well, not the city.
Right. You know, most folks in St. Louis did not vote for him, but in Missouri, Missouri did vote for him. You know, from Trump voters that I've talked to, no. You know, the ones who voted for him under the illusion that they were going to get jobs, they're going to get infrastructure, and most of all, stability. A lot of people paradoxically looked at him and they thought, you know, this is a tough CEO kind of guy. You know, he's going to help make our chaotic life easier and more predictable. And of course, the opposite has happened. It's been extremely volatile because he's extremely volatile. I think his parts of his base, the type of people for whom his racism and xenophobia was the primary attraction, yeah, they're probably getting what they want.
Yeah. Why do you think his approval ratings seem to not go up, but not go down really from the election results?
I actually, you know, I think some of that is the attitude toward the media that a lot of people who voted for Trump have. Because when I talk to Trump voters, not as a journalist, just as like a fellow person living in Missouri, they're very frustrated with him, or they have a very ambivalent attitude. But if they're going to be polled, I think they're very unlikely to say that they disapprove of him, because they see that as kind of putting forth a mandate, like, okay, his base has left him, his supporters have left him, people want to impeach him, so what'll happen? You know, the dreaded Hillary may appear, or a Democrat may appear. I mean, just because they dislike Trump doesn't mean that they like the other side. And so I think there's sort of a reluctance to trust the media to answer these sort of questions honestly. But I've seen a lot of disillusionment and ambivalent from Trump voters over the last year.
Your book is a collection of essays that you reported for Al Jazeera. You originally published this as an e-book in 2015, and the topics range from Russia and the Middle East to the Middle West, from the Mideast to the Midwest, in this book, also known as Flyover Country. What do people in America have in common with some of those in the autocratic states that you write about, the authoritarian ruled states, that they would want an authoritarian in this country?
I don't think people set out looking for an authoritarian, unfortunately. Authoritarian is usually a demagogue. If you're starting out, at least in a democratic society, who's very skilled at manipulating the pain of people in order to rise to power, you know, on false promises. And, you know, what we have in common with, you know, any country, but especially with Central Asian states, is corruption. And, you know, also an intense frustration with corruption, with opportunity hoarding. And in terms of how Trump governs, I think he's, you know, above all, a kleptocrat. He's somebody who came into power in order to enhance his personal wealth and has been willing to abuse executive privilege to disregard civil liberties in order to accomplish that. And that's exactly how rulers in Central Asia, you know, or other former Soviet states like Azerbaijan have been governing. And it's very unfortunate. I mean, I should specify this is different. You know, we're starting from a different place. A lot of those countries have never been a democracy, so the expectations are different and the awareness is different. But we are all dealing with corruption and injustice on a massive scale.
And you refer to the current state in the U.S. as the post-employment economy.
Yes.
And yet, people, enough people, I mean, Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, but enough people in our electoral college system preferred the kleptocrat to the establishment manager of the economy, if that's how you want to characterize Clinton.
I think people in terms of the economy are frustrated with both options. I also think Trump was not vetted well by the press in terms of things like his bankruptcies, his history of ties to the mafia, money laundering, et cetera. I think a lot of folks, especially out where I live, knew him primarily as the host of The Apprentice. They thought his tycoon image was reality. And so they kind of bought into that. But, you know, it wasn't something that they weren't out looking for a kleptocratic guy who would instill his family members and, you know, use the White House like an ATM.
My guest is Sarah Kendzior. Her book is The View from Flyover Country, Dispatches from the Forgotten America. And we can take your phone calls for her at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Maybe read her columns in the Globe and Mail, which we'll get to some of as we go. But let's take a phone call right now. Here's Sarah in Ridgefield. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brian. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question for Sarah, as I said to your screener, I am a dedicated follower of you on Twitter. Like, I always make sure to read your columns. I saw the appearance that you made at the Los Angeles Times Book Festival that was broadcast on C-SPAN. And I see that a lot of the advice that you've been giving is to kind of give a call out to the media to pay more attention to what Trump is doing and to be more aware. But I don't have like a column or a TV show or a radio show. I'm just one person. I'm terrified.
Hang on.
And
okay.
I would like to know what you could suggest that me as one person I'd be doing.
Well, thank you for calling and thank you for your kind words. And I think
thank you, Sarah, for your courage.
Yes.
Because if it's this upsetting, then it took courage to come on the air and say what you said. Go ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, the first thing I want to say is, you know, you're not alone. In multiple respects, you're not alone in feeling this way, in feeling this desperation and fear, and you're also not alone in trying to remedy it and trying to solve it. You know, I hear from a lot of people who feel like they have the weight of the world on their shoulders, and that's because of, you know, the failure of our institutions, the failure of our officials, our media, you know, to do the sorts of jobs, you know, keep Trump accountable, stop this corruption, enhance the lives of people. But you know, just speaking out is something that you can do. You know, I think I wrote in an essay a long time ago, like, if you feel like you can't be brave, if that's too hard, then be kind. Be kind to others. You know, reach out in your community. And, you know, it's okay to take a break. It's okay to take a break from the news. It's okay to just take a break from this kind of hell and make sure you can get through the day. Like, that's really important. So, you know, don't feel bad about doing that. You know, like, I'm impressed that you came on the show to talk about this. I'm grateful that you have this level of concern for the well-being of our country. in our society. And, you know, we need more people like you. You know, we need people who care about this. And I do think that we have millions of people who do. And it's just a matter of, you know, working together to fight these elements of corruption. And, you know, I see that happening all the time. Often it flies under the radar, but it is there. And you're not alone.
Thank you.
Sarah, thank you very much. Let's go to Linda in East Windsor. You're on WNYC. Linda, hi.
Good morning. I'm calling in response to what I think is a false divide in this country. I live on the East Coast, always have. Family members and I have worked in Manhattan. We live in New Jersey. But it doesn't mean that we don't have the same needs, desires, and work ethic as people in the quote-unquote flyover country. I and my family, we think about the center of the country and where people are going to go for jobs in the future. You know, they are not forgotten. And I think that people are trying to put this divide, and it's at the hands of Donald Trump and his followers who talk about this. We know that the biggest impact for the workforce in the United States, both coasts and in the center, is automation and robotics. And how are we going to employ these people? It doesn't just affect the flyover.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I have a whole section actually in the introduction of the book about how, you know, this myth of red and blue America is just a myth, you know, that we're purple, that we're, you know, we are maybe united more because of suffering and pain and frustration, especially on the economy, especially issues like automation. They do affect everybody. I think that there is a divide between the absolute, you know, wealthiest elites in the vast majority of the country. And that's not necessarily a geographic divide. You know, I'm in New York now at one of these centers of power, and I can find, you know, people who are sleeping on the streets. Like, there are people suffering everywhere. And I do think that, you know, what's happened is, you know, the media has become conglomerated in these cities. So you're much less likely to hear about what goes on in St. Louis on a day-to-day basis than you are in New York. And I think that that lends to this perception of it being forgotten. But I think also people who are suffering in cities on the East Coast, on the West Coast, you know, their plight is often neglected as well. So unfortunately, you know, that's a quality that brings this country together.
And let me read people a line from that section of your book. You wrote, at this contentious point in our history, these divergent Americans are unified most, unfortunately, by a collective sense of pain. So America is purple, purple like a bruise.
Yeah, exactly.
And Linda, thank you for your call. You write that the United States' current contentious climate is the flip side of the false promise of hope that we saw half a decade ago. Are you referring here to President Obama's campaigns? As you know, there was that famous poster of him, Obama Hope, false promise of hope.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think that Obama set out like to deceive everyone and make people feel hopeful and then not deliver. I think Obama did try to deliver on his promises, but was dealing with two wars, was dealing with a gigantic economic crisis that was created by his predecessor. I was dealing with a very obstinate and racist GOP. You know, I'm not sure a president has inherited a set of problems like Obama. You know, where I feel like the Obama administration went awry, though, was kind of holding on to that hope, you know, turning into a kind of blind faith that things were going to get better, instead of acknowledging the severity of pain that people were experiencing, especially in regions where I live. You know, they would tout their low unemployment statistics, you know, like 5% unemployment, where there was underemployment, where there were people unable to pay their bills. And that was something, unfortunately, that Trump was able to tap into very well. Like, I'll never forget the day Trump said that there's 40% unemployment, and a lot of pundits on the coast, you know, laughed and said, you know, who would fall for that? Like, that's so ridiculous. Obviously, it's not 40%. And my heart sank, because to me, you know, I knew it was a lie, but it was a lie that felt true. It was a lie that felt emotionally resonant, because it described the situation in which most people who I knew lived. And I knew that they would see Trump as somebody who cared. And I knew that is false hope. That is a false pretense.
Jeff in Morristown, you're on WNYC with Sarah Kendzior, author of Flyover Country. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A quick comment on what was just said about being purple. I'm actually a local candidate for our town council in our town here. And when I walk around talking to voters, and they ask me, yes, I'm a Democrat in a slightly Republican area. But I tell people that, you know, it's a bell curve. You know, America is a bell curve. And most people are in the center. You're either a little bit right or a little bit left, but we have so much more in common than we have differences. And I think that's something you were just trying to get at. Just a quick comment there. My question is, with regard to how Trump played out in Missouri and other places, how do you think Bernie Sanders would have done going up against Trump, being able to talk tough like him on certain issues?
I think Bernie is another candidate who wasn't vetted especially hard, so it's difficult to tell. I think certain things like Bernie calling himself a Democratic Socialist would not have played well in Missouri. You know, sometimes when I'd go out and interview people, like one house I went to was a picture of Obama with, you know, devil horns on it and the word socialist underneath. So, you know, I kind of wonder about that. I do think Bernie understood the economic issues, you know, better to some extent than Hillary, at least in identifying, you know, the frustration that people were going through. But, you know, Trump did a lot of stuff, you know, that was illicit, that was corrupt. That helped him, you know, rise to the top. We were also dealing with structural changes in this election, like the partial repeal of the VRA that led to voter suppression. You know, there were so many weird, you know, such a conglomeration of bizarre things that it's hard to predict how he would have played out. But in the primary, Hillary narrowly beat Bernie in the Missouri primary. So I think, I don't know, it may well have been about the same. Maybe, you know, some of the misogynists would have switched to Bernie. I don't know.
Jeff, thank you for your call. Let me ask you about some of your columns recently in the Globe and Mail. Two of them from recent days seem kind of connected thematically. One, no, Trump isn't suddenly concerned with al-Assad's war crimes. And the other, Donald Trump will do anything to avoid prosecution and John Bolton will help. On a theme, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, a very apocalyptic theme.
meaning that you think he's using the National Security Advisor post and the flamboyance of John Bolton and the, you know, him as a lightning rod and even the attack on Syria as a distraction from his scandals?
It's not only that it's a distraction. I mean, I think it kind of serves as one, but also, you know, Trump has been fascinated by war and particularly fascinated by nuclear weapons for 30 years. He said he knew everything he needed to know about nuclear weapons. He learned it in an hour and a half. Bolton is a similar kind of personality. You know, he's a warmonger. He's never had a question to which war is not the answer. And so I obviously am very concerned about them making incursions into Syria. You know, I vehemently oppose Assad and wish we had done something years ago. But I think that they're looking at Syria as a kind of entree into a broader Middle Eastern regional conflict, you know, probably incorporating Iran, where Bolton has long wanted to go to war. And I think Trump realizes, as, you know, many presidents do, that war is something that will distract the public from a scandal. I mean, we have more than a scandal. We have a crisis. You know, we basically have a constitutional crisis, a federal probe, a question of whether Trump is a traitor to his nation. I mean, those are new kind of questions. I'm not sure a war will exactly distract us from that, but it'll certainly make matters worse. I'll just say that.
So are you watching this Macron visit today with great interest? Because the headline, at least leading into it, is that Macron's going to try to talk Trump and Bolton into staying in the Iran deal.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what Macron is up to, because, you know, the best way to get Trump to not do something is to say that you want him to do it and make sure that you know that it's your idea and that you're like the young French president coming in and excuse me, and telling Trump, you know, here's what you're going to do. Then Trump is probably going to be obstinate to say no. And so sometimes I wonder if Macron is kind of using reverse psychology on him. And maybe it's not that complex. Maybe he's genuine in his offer. But I do think if we are going to be involved in Syria, it is better to do it with an international alliance of rational people. You know, we need a broad strategy. We can't just keep striking places without any kind of, you know, strategy in mind. And, you know, neither Trump nor Bolton has had any kind of geopolitical acumen in that regard beyond just war and bombs.
Simon in Bloomfield, you're on WNYC with Sarah Kendzior. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Sarah. Pleasure to hear you speak. My question relates to the comment you made earlier about sort of this collective pain we all feel and that being the thing that unites us as so many Americans. And I totally vibe with that, and I think that is the case. And I'm wondering, how our economic system, capitalism, has what that has to do with it, and how you see sort of an economic evolution sort of beginning to alleviate that collective pain.
What was the last part you said? What would alleviate it?
How you see an economic evolution maybe alleviating that collective pain.
Evolution.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if the evolution or revolution. you know, I think, you know, we've been in trouble for a long time. I think after the Great Recession, you know, from which much of America did not recover, a lot of corporations used that as an excuse to enforce a lot of exploitative labor practices, which at the time they labeled as temporary, but which have become permanent, you know, a sort of pay-to-play scenario where you have unpaid labor as a prerequisite for job, very expensive degrees. You know, opportunity hoarding that locks out a lot of Americans. And I think we have reached a crisis point with that. I think people kind of thought, all right, you know, this is just what happened because of the recession. Let's just blame the recession. Now they realize it's a restructuring. And people are very impatient. You know, you can't get by. You can't pay your bills. When you feel desperate like that, I think you're more willing to call the problem out for what it is. And that's the change I've seen in the last few years, is people just, you know, finally identifying that what we call everyday life, the suffering of everyday life, is a crisis into itself and needs to be treated like one. It's not something that can just go on forever. How it'll be solved, I don't know, because Trump has made it worse. You know, he's stripping away the social safety net. The Republicans have that as a, you know, core foundation of their ideology. That's an actual goal. So I'm not very optimistic about change being put forth by a GOP-dominated Congress, but I do have more optimism in American people for recognizing this, for looking out for each other, and, you know, calling for change like you are.
And so it's a crisis of capitalism. And yet, as you were describing earlier, socialist is still the dirty word to call anybody who's a Democrat.
Yeah, you know, in some parts of the country, I think it is. I think once it's explained to people that actually, you know, what Sanders and others want to do is bring America back to some of the policies we've already had, you know, policies put forth in the New Deal, then it's not quite as foreign, it's not quite as threatening. It's often things people want. You know, people want health care. They want, you know, their basic needs taken care of. That's a right, not a privilege. And I think when it's phrased differently, people do accept that.
Sarah Kendzior, that's Kendzior. Her book is The View from Flyover Country, Dispatches from the Forgotten America. And if you're interested in hearing more, Sarah will be reading at the Housing Works Bookstore Cafe in conversation with Amy Siskind on Wednesday tomorrow at 7 p.m. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.